Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. And we're devoting a lot of the programme today to the intensifying conflict between Israel and the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, which has certainly ratcheted up this week following Israel's announcement that it was to start a new phase of the war. There were 2 days of exploding communications devices owned by Hezbollah militants in Lebanon, with dozens killed and thousands injured, among them children. The two sides have stepped up their exchanges of fire across the Lebanon border. Israel says it's hit more than 100 Hezbollah rocket launchers, while Hezbollah has fired dozens of rockets into northern Israel. And Israel has once again carried out an airstrike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut, killing, it says, the head of an elite Hezbollah unit and other commanders. At a news briefing, the chief spokesman of the Israel Defense Forces, Daniel Hagari, gave details of the attack.
Today, the IDF conducted a targeted strike in Beirut on senior terrorist Ibrahim Akil, the head of Hezbollah's operations and the commander of Hezbollah's elite Radwan forces. I can now confirm that Ibrahim Akil was eliminated together with other senior terrorists in Hezbollah's Radwan forces.
That was the chief spokesman of the Israel Defense Forces, Daniel Hagari. And a short while ago, I spoke to the BBC's Ugo Bachega in Beirut.
I was in Dahir earlier today, near the site of this attack. This is an area of Beirut that is a stronghold of Hezbollah. So again, an Israeli attack targeting senior members of the group in their command center here in the capital.
And there was a lot of destruction, was there, as a result of this Israeli airstrike?
Yes, at least one building collapsed as a result of this attack. There was a lot of damage, a lot of rubble as well. Rescue teams were still trying to search for people who were believed to be under the rubble. I mean, this is a densely populated neighborhood of Beirut, and this happened at around 4 p.m. here, so that the streets were busy, shops were packed with people, so there is the possibility that the death toll is going to go higher, and obviously there was a lot of destruction there as a result of this attack.
And has Hezbollah acknowledged the death of Ibrahim Akil and the others?
So there hasn't been any reaction from Hezbollah yet, and obviously this is happening as we're seeing an escalation in this conflict between Hezbollah and Israel. Today was a very intense day of cross-border attacks. Last night we saw one of the most intense wave of Israeli airstrikes targeting positions in southern Lebanon. And today we're seeing the war that has been relatively contained to areas along the border coming here to the capital, Beirut. And I think a lot of people here are concerned that they believe this is just the beginning of a possible wider Israeli offensive against Hezbollah. And many here fear that more attacks like this could come.
That was the BBC's Ugo Bachega in Beirut. Well, Hezbollah has today fired over 100 rockets into northern Israel. That's according to the Israeli military. The BBC's Paul Adams has spent the day in northern Israel on the edge of the city of Kiryat Shemona and in the town of Rosh Pina.
It's been a fascinating day because at one level we saw an escalation here in the north of the country, with volley after volley of rockets fired across the border from nearby Lebanon. Just a short time after we arrived here in Rosh Pina late this afternoon, there was another salvo of 15 or 20 rockets intercepted right overhead by Israel's Iron Dome system. So the Israeli air defenses have been busy all day. But it comes at a time when I think Israelis feel that the tide of this bit of the war, if I can call it that, this war along Israel's northern border, that the tide of this conflict may be turning.
Are there still Israelis living in the north?
Well, it's a mixed picture. So there is an evacuation zone which runs close to the border, around 5 kilometres along the border, which stretches from the Mediterranean Sea in the west all the way up to Kiryat Shmona and Matula in the north, and then east towards the Golan Heights. In those places, most people, and we're talking about around 60,000 people in all, have long since left. Now, some people come back. They come back briefly. They come back to check on their homes. In one or two communities that we visited today, we could see just a handful of people were still resident. But it has become too dangerous. You know, the border is a short distance away. They are exhausted, frankly, by month after month, almost a year of air raid alerts, of rockets firing overhead, of interceptions, you know, visible from their balconies. So they are extremely anxious for the government to do something to change the dynamic along the border. And they feel that that is happening. This was the week when the government said that the return of Israeli citizens to their homes in the north was now one of the of its war aims. And we are clearly seeing a significant stepping up of Israel's war on Hezbollah, you know, in incredibly dramatic fashion. It seems as though the government, the Israeli government, has decided that this is that enough is enough, and that it needs to crush Hezbollah.
Hezbollah said today that one of its targets was what it described as the main intelligence headquarters in northern Israel, which is responsible for assassinations. What might they have meant by that?
Well, they could have meant pretty much anything. I mean, we could see that some of the targets, they were up on the Golan Heights. They were down much further down into Israel around Safat and close to the Sea of Galilee. There is nothing to suggest today that anything of any significance has been hit. Now, obviously, anything that was sensitive, we might be subject to censorship and we might not hear about it until afterwards. But we've not heard anything on the news today to suggest that Hezbollah has hit anything of any consequence. And so I think that messaging from Hezbollah itself might be wishful thinking.
That was the BBC's Paul Adams speaking from northern Israel. And let's find out more now about the senior Hezbollah commander, Ibrahim Akil, who Israel says it killed today in the airstrike on Beirut. He was certainly important within the militant group, described variously as a member of Hezbollah's governing Jihad Council and a commander of the Radwan Special Forces Unit, and with a long history of striking not just Israeli but US targets as well. Firas Maqsad is a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. How significant a figure was Ibrahim Akil?
Very significant. The Radwan forces are obviously the special operation forces, pretty much the elite fighting force of Hezbollah. And Akil was not only the commander of that, but reportedly after Israel's assassination of Hezbollah's chief of staff back in July 30th, Akil had also taken on that role. So from late-breaking reports, this is quite a significant hit, particularly that there are some indications that not only was he killed alone, but with the entire command of that special operations unit within Hezbollah.
And that special operations unit, what did it do?
These are the elite fighting force of Hezbollah, sort of the equivalent of the Marines, so to speak, in the United States. Within them is the anti-tank fighting brigades that are deployed in the south, very effective in terms of their firing on Israeli settlements. And so this is the creme de la creme of Hezbollah's fighting force, and it's a pretty embarrassing and devastating blow.
So what would they have been doing in recent weeks, recent months? Are they involved in southern Lebanon?
Very much so. In fact, part of the diplomatic deal that the Biden administration has been trying to unlock between Hezbollah and Israel is the redeployment of that Radwan force some 8 to 10 kilometers away from the Israel border, together with Israel perhaps withdrawing from some disputed points along the border. So the Radwan forces and their command structure have been at the heart of, you know, the cross-border fire that Israel has been a target of, and very much at the center of the negotiations and the deal that the U.S. is trying to broker.
How long has Akil been a member of Hezbollah, and what sort of operations has he been involved in the past? I understand that there was some involvement by him in the 1983 bombings in Beirut of U.S. targets.
Akil is wanted by the U.S. He had been there from day one in terms of Hezbollah's formation back when it was called the Islamic Jihad, really the early days of Hezbollah. And he is one of two, and perhaps even actually the last member of that jihadi council, that sort of top council of Hezbollah that was still alive. So this is a veteran of Hezbollah with a great deal of experience that he brought to the table for the organization. And no doubt they're going to be reeling from that very heavy blow they suffered today on the back end, obviously, of the dismantlement of their communication infrastructure with the walkie-talkie and beeper operation Israel carried out.
So tell me a little bit more about his involvement in those 1983 bombings in Beirut.
Well, what we do know is that he was involved in planning and in carrying out those attacks against the Marine barracks in Beirut.
But it did result in the loss of a large number of American lives.
Some 230, 240 Marines are believed to have lost their lives as a result of that operation. And it led, I must say, to an eventual withdrawal of the multinational force, which the U.S. and France had been spearheading to try and bring the Lebanese civil war to some kind of a close.
I mean, we've had, it would seem, a degrading of Hezbollah in the course of this week. There were the explosions of the communications devices, and now this attack on its leaders. Is it any longer a significant fighting force, a threat to Israel?
One of the big questions we're going to be left with today as we search for answers is, has Hezbollah been effectively emasculated by these operations? We won't know. Degraded would be a safer way to describe it at this point, but I will bet that Israel will try to take advantage of the strong blows it struck in the past 2 days to try and have Hezbollah decouple the Lebanon front from Gaza. Hezbollah has made it a precondition that a ceasefire in Gaza be attained for cross-border fire to stop from Lebanon. And that is the stated objective of the Israeli offensive. To my mind, it is one that is unlikely to be achieved. Hezbollah is the most powerful fighting force in the world. It has a stockpile of over 150,000 rockets. But certainly the events of the past 48 hours will cause many of us to pause and reconsider.
Firas Maqsad, and later in the program, we'll hear from a Lebanese MP and a former U.S. ambassador in Beirut. This is NewsHour. Also coming up, how art therapy is helping people who've lost family members in the war in Ukraine.
Their paintings depict something that reminds them of the time they spent together or of the dreams they had. They paint themselves, their husbands. Very often they paint angels. Their families or children are depicted as angels. There are a lot of landscapes showing places where they met or were happy together. These paintings mark the end of the life they had and the beginning of a new life.
And the latest headlines from the BBC newsroom, the UN Security Council has heard warnings that any further escalation in hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah across the Lebanese border could lead to suffering even greater than that in Gaza. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. China has fortified its border with Myanmar by building higher walls and holding military drills as the civil war on its doorstep threatens its investments and its economy. Beijing has also dispatched its top diplomat, Wang Yi, to try to persuade Myanmar's military rulers to return to peace talks and hold nationwide elections as promised. Myanmar has been thrown into fresh chaos in recent months after a China-brokered ceasefire in the north of the country fell apart. Armed ethnic groups have made huge gains, capturing key cities and towns on the main road to China's border, which some believe could be a turning point in this civil war. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker has this report from the Chinese border.
Ni hao. It's like a jade necklace. A Burma jade.
Burmese jade traders in China beckon us to their stalls.
Very beautiful.
They're desperate for a sale. 70% of the world's jade comes from Myanmar, and yet they tell us the price has plummeted. Strict COVID lockdowns have ravaged this border economy, and now the war has blocked key trade routes into China. Beijing desperately needs stability if it's to rebuild local businesses. Your country's at war. Just accept what I give you, shouts one Chinese man, haggling for a bargain.
Oh, yeah, the market's lovely. Got colourful flags all around it.
The local maze-like market has stalls brimming with other goods, from milk, tea to tobacco. The few people that make it over the border to China are searching for peace. They have hopes of prosperity. But stallholder Li Mianjian says it's hard to make a living when so many here are just glad to be alive.
It's really, really cruel. I don't know when things can start to improve. I hope some decent people can tell outsiders to stop fighting so the ordinary people can suffer less. Otherwise, it's really tragic for us. You know, the bombshells hit hospitals. People were killed, including women giving birth there.
For Myanmar families with the right paperwork, the Chinese city of Reili has become a safe haven.
From here in the middle of the square in the baking sun, I can see over the border into Myanmar. Scattered around the square are mostly women with lots of their belongings. Some have their papers on the ground as they try to get a work permit in order.
Another border checkpoint. China fortified this once porous border during the pandemic, building higher fences, more checkpoints. Loudspeakers still warn Chinese tourists to stay back from the high steel fence. Just a few miles away, armed insurgents have stepped up their fight against the military regime. A Beijing-brokered ceasefire was ripped apart, and thousands have fled the fighting. In response, China is holding regular military exercises along the border. State media said this is to maintain order. Beijing also dispatched its top diplomat Wang Yi to Myanmar to push military rulers to hold promised elections. After long shifts making car parts and clothes, dozens of Burmese workers relax playing volleyball. They've been brought from Myanmar as cheap labour for Chinese factories. Zenong is 31 and fears he would have been forced to fight if he'd stayed.
There is nothing we can do because war is happening in Myanmar. Everything is expensive. Everywhere there is a battle going on, and everyone has to run because of war.
His work here comes with conditions. The movement of Burmese workers is often restricted. And enterprising locals have set up food and karaoke stalls to keep them entertained. The future prospects of this town and these workers are in Chinese hands. As Beijing calculates just how big a part it's willing to play in Myanmar's fate.
Our correspondent Laura Bicker reporting from the border between China and Myanmar. This time yesterday, we were bringing you the news revealed by the BBC that several women had accused the late Mohammed Al-Fayed, the former owner of the London luxury store Harrods, of raping them. Today, lawyers representing some of the 37 women who've now accused Al-Fayed of rape and sexual assault said the billionaire who died last year was a monster whose behaviour was enabled by the department store. Gloria Allred is a US attorney and representative of the international legal team and spoke to my colleague Tim Franks. Are there more he asked her, who may have suffered at the hands of Al-Fayed.
Absolutely more. In fact, additional victims are contacting the barristers. They began contacting them as soon as the BBC documentary began to be broadcast yesterday. And then they are still getting contacted by even more victims today. The barristers have been working for more than a year investigating this matter and representing some of the victims. So, yes, they think that they have strong legal arguments to make, strong factual arguments to make, and definitely there will be more victims that will be represented by these barristers.
And obviously every single victim has a terrible story to tell, but along with that comes the mind-boggling question, and it's the same one that we asked about Epstein and Weinstein and the other powerful men who've been predators, is how could they get away with it for so long and with so many victims?
And that is an important question. And part of it is because the victims were threatened by Mohammed Al-Fayed if they came forward or told anybody. They had to keep it a secret. He told them that usually every time after he victimized them. And also said that we know where your family lives, and suggested to one of them they would never work in London again if they told anybody about what he had done to them, and actually did inflict gender violence on some of the victims, that even after they said no, they did not want him to rape them, to attempt to rape them, to assault them, then sometimes he would force himself on them anyway. He knew exactly what he was doing. He used Harrods and many of the employees at Harrods to recruit the victims. Some of them were just people shopping in a store, 15-year-old girls, 14-year-old girls at the time, shopping in Harrods, and he looked at her and decided he wanted her and went up to her and offered employment to her.
Given that Al-Fayed died last year, what does justice look like?
Justice, well, it's never too late to do the right thing. And offering to resolve this case in a way that would be meaningful to the victims is something Harrods can do. The new owners have suggested that Harrods did fail these victims, and that's a good start. But we need to have meaningful financial compensation for the victims so they can pay their therapy bills, their physician bills, and more bills, lost wages.
That was U.S. Attorney Gloria Allred. And if you want to listen to the full investigation, you can hear it on the World of Secrets podcast, Al-Fayed Predator at Harrods, wherever you get your BBC podcast. Do stay with us, though, here on NewsHour. A lot more to come in the next 30 minutes. My colleague James Menendez has been reporting from Oregon in the northwest of the United States this week. And one of the quirks of the state, he says, is that it's home to a pretty sizable number of what are known as preppers or survivalists, people devoted to prepping or preparing for some kind of emergency. For some, at the most extreme end, that's the threat of US federal forces coming to take your land. For others, it's preparing for a natural calamity, as James has been finding out.
It's a beautiful day today in Portland. The sun is shining, not too much wind, blue sky, everything seems very peaceful. But I'm with a man who's worried about what might happen in the future in this area. Marcel Rodriguez, we're on your deck, yep, in your backyard. What are you worried about?
The big worry is a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake.
They've well, what does that mean, first
well,
of all?
Yeah, so traditionally, approximately every 300 years, there has been a very large earthquake, about a magnitude 9 plus, in a fault off of the coast of Oregon that runs basically all the way from British Columbia all the way down to around the California border. And we know that the last one happened in 1700 because of records from Japan, because of the tsunami that happened after that, as well as some records that we have locally from geological stuff. And so we're currently sitting at year 324 for an event that happens approximately every 300 years.
And if that did happen, what would that look like for Portland?
Bad day, really bad day. It would mean region-wide destruction, you know, pretty much Washington, Oregon, and parts of California. pretty much most of the infrastructure gone, as well as, you know, the hospitals, the power, communications, all of that, pretty much either severely compromised or completely gone. But we also have recently had wildfires, multiple years. We've had wildfires that were either so bad we had to shelter in place because the air was so bad, or I was involved in evacuating local areas right outside the city where the fires were literally, you know, burning the houses down, and we were going door to door and pulling people out.
So it's not paranoia?
No. These are real things that happen.
So are you a prepper? Is that a dirty word now?
I wouldn't say that it's a dirty word. It's a loaded word.
There are some hardcore preppers in the state, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing is it sort of sometimes comes down to what event you feel that you're planning for. And for me personally, I think, you know, we plan for a wide variety of natural or man-made disasters. And for that, you know, I feel pretty prepared for those.
What about if there were civil unrest, for example, in the wake of a disputed election? Does that keep you awake at night?
I mean, yes and no. We've had that. I mean, like, we literally had that. And I would say is that those kind of things, you know, it's the same. To me, that's the same philosophy that I would apply to any situation, which is this a shelter-in-place situation or is this an evacuation situation?
That was NewsHour's James Menendez speaking to Marcel Rodriguez in the U.S. state of Oregon. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall, and we return to our top story. The Israeli military is saying it's killed around 10 Hezbollah commanders in an airstrike in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. The most senior is said to be Ibrahim Akil, acting head of the group's elite Radwan unit. The crisis is being discussed by the UN Security Council. Speaking to reporters before the meeting, Israel's ambassador to the UN, Danny Danon, said Ibrahim Akil had received a fair punishment for his actions against Israel.
Akil was one of the most wanted men on the planet, with a $7 million reward on his head for the 1983 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut and other terror attacks. He was responsible for the murder of hundreds of Americans, and Israel served him the justice he so richly deserved.
But the UN human rights chief, Volker Türk, said he was appalled by the indiscriminate targeting of thousands of people in Lebanon this week through the explosion of communications devices, saying it violated international law. He condemned those responsible for the attacks.
International humanitarian law prohibits the use of booby-trap devices in the form of apparently harmless portable objects which are specifically designed and constructed to contain explosive material. It is a war crime to commit violence intended to spread terror among civilians.
Well, the avoidance to date of a full-blown war between Israel and Hezbollah has been touted by U.S. officials as a core achievement of the past 11 months amid failures to halt the enormous death toll in Gaza and secure a ceasefire. But with Israel now exploding communications devices in Lebanon and targeting Hezbollah commanders, is the United States losing control of its close ally Israel and the means to defuse the growing crisis? I've been speaking to Jeffrey Feltman, who was U.S. ambassador in Beirut during the war between Israel and Hezbollah in 2006. I asked him if he thought it was plausible that the United States had no idea what Israel was up to in Lebanon.
I think the United States understands very clearly that the Israelis have a political and a military and security problem that they're trying to resolve. I do not believe that the United States is aware in advance of each step that Israel will take to try to address those issues. But there's a very real political, military, and security issue that the United States has talked about with the Israelis for years, and with particular intensity after October 7th with the tit-for-tat and risks of full-scale war between Lebanon and Israel.
And the United States holds Israel's security and the steps that it takes to ensure its security above possible human rights violations, which is what the UN has described those exploding communications devices in Lebanon this week as.
Well, I think that You know, yes, the United States does take Israel's security very, very seriously, but they also take the risk of a regional war extremely seriously, because a regional war would have devastating consequences for people across the region. I was U.S. ambassador in 2006. The 2006 war ended up with 1,200 dead Lebanese, infrastructure destroyed throughout the country. And this, if there were a war now, it would be far, far worse for the Lebanese and for the Israelis. And so, as I understand it, the Biden administration has put as a priority trying to minimize the risks of the type of escalation that could trigger war. But I do not believe that the United States has command and control over what the Israelis are going to do and have done to try to address their political, military, and security threats.
But do you believe that what Israel is doing now in Lebanon is complicating efforts by the United States to secure a ceasefire in Gaza?
Well, without question, what the Israelis have done this week has increased the risk for regional war that the U.S. is trying to stop, without question. This is an increasingly dangerous period. And even if the Israelis believe that what they are doing is going to lead Hezbollah to back down, it could result in the opposite. It could result in the war that the United States has been trying to prevent. I mean, in my working in Lebanon and on issues in the Middle East, a rule of thumb has been never underestimate Hezbollah. Hezbollah is kind of on the back foot this week, I would say, with the communications explosions, with the apparent death today of Ibrahim Akil. But one should never underestimate Hezbollah. It's a much more dangerous adversary than Hamas has been in Gaza.
Staying with the assassination of Ibrahim Akil, we spoke earlier to a commentator who was not 100% certain of his involvement in the 1983 bombings in Beirut of the U.S. Embassy and of U.S. Marines then. What's your view?
Obviously, I was not in Lebanon in 1983, but from everything I understand from my service in the U.S. government in Lebanon and elsewhere, that he was very much involved. He was a commander in Hezbollah from the beginning of Hezbollah's history. He's been part of the Jihad Council, the senior military political leadership of Hezbollah. And I'd like to point out that there's a coincidence of justice. 40 years ago today, September 20th, 1984, was the second Hezbollah suicide bombing against the U.S. embassy. 23 people were killed. The Marine barracks were exploded in October 1983. The first embassy bombing that everyone remembers was in April 1983. We believe Ibrahim Akil was one of the masterminds and planners behind that.
So the U.S. government will not be shedding tears over his death.
No, in fact, the U.S. government had a $7 million reward for information that could lead to his arrest or death.
So you clearly don't believe, from what you were suggesting earlier, that his death and the other death of the other Hezbollah commanders is the end of Hezbollah.
No, I don't. Hezbollah has proven to be remarkably resilient. The 2006 war ended in what was essentially a stalemate. Look at what Hezbollah has done since that 2006 war ended. They have increased the size of their arsenal. They have increased the sophistication of their arsenal with precision-guided munitions. They now have battle experience from supporting the murderous regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria on the ground. They were fighting on the ground on behalf of Bashar al-Assad. This is a much stronger Hezbollah than the Hezbollah that had been battered by Israel in 2006. Israel has taken out a number of Hezbollah leaders over the years, including, of course, Fuad Shukr in July, and now, apparently today, Ibrahim Akil. But Hezbollah has proven to have a deep enough bench to replace those. So Israel has a real security threat. Israel has a political issue in that tens of thousands of people cannot safely go home to the north. So I understand why Israel is taking steps, but I'm not convinced that these are the steps that are going to allow the people to go home and also facilitate the U.S. efforts to prevent a regional war.
That was Jeffrey Feltman. He was U.S. ambassador in Beirut during the Lebanon War in 2006. So what do the Lebanese make of what's been happening in their country this week? The explosion of communications devices and now the airstrike in Beirut, which Israel says has killed senior Hezbollah commanders. I've been speaking to Paolo Yacoubian, an MP in Lebanon and a member of the National Coalition Party, which is a liberal centrist party.
Well, definitely it's a big blow.
and an embarrassment. And it comes after another big blow with the talkie-walkies and the pagers. This is unprecedented, unheard of. It's a new kind of methods. This is a game changer in the killing methods. But I'm not sure it's a game changer in the conflict. And I totally agree with Mr. Ambassador, what he was saying. He's someone who knows Lebanon very well.
So you don't feel that Hezbollah in the long run has been weakened by this week's developments?
No, I would say yes, Hezbollah was definitely weakened. However, Hezbollah is much, much stronger than Hamas. Hamas was under blockade for 16 years. Hezbollah has an open highway till Iran. He has a huge support within some of the Lebanese populations, especially the Shia. The Hezbollah is definitely still strong. However, it was a very, very big blow. And I don't think even Hezbollah expected anything like that. So it was a surprise. And I'm sure that Hezbollah is under shock, just like all Lebanese. We are watching something that looks like science fiction. It's surreal. The war is getting to somewhere, the least you can say, surreal.
Do you feel, though, that you are on the brink of another war, such as in 2006?
Well, the war now, closer and closer. I mean, if you asked me a few days ago, I would have said there would be no an all-out war, because both parties, they know that the destruction can be very big. Till today, Israel is unable of finishing between brackets or fulfilling its objectives in Gaza. So opening another front with all the unknown that it can bring, you know, starting an invasion or a war in Lebanon like 2006, this time I think it would be different. The Golan Heights, the Syrians, they cannot stay neutral. I don't think that Iran would allow any kind of wipeout to Hezbollah or anyone to try that, because Hezbollah is much more strategic and important to Iran than any other proxy. It's their success story. Since the 90s, they're trying to have, you know, other replicas of Hezbollah in many countries. The Houthis are one of them, the Fasa'il Ahl al-Haq in Iraq, in Bahrain. Everywhere where there's Shia, Iran tried to, you know, have another model of Hezbollah, and they were never as successful in Iran's eyes and Iran's objective as Hezbollah. So Hezbollah is very important for Iran, and it's part of its massive arsenal.
But do the Lebanese really need another war? Things are bad enough already, are they not?
Absolutely. This is what we're saying all the time. We cannot afford another war. The country is in its worst financial meltdown. The crisis is weighing on all Lebanese. The conditions here are very, very difficult. The last thing we can, you know, still have is a war. I mean, metaphorically, Lebanese are saying, I mean, we're still waiting for, I don't know, something. It's just like I said, it is surreal what's happening in Lebanon, the crisis that are happening all the time. No, definitely they cannot handle a new war. But are they the Lebanese who decide? Do we have the decision? The decision is hijacked by Iran. And I think that Israel or the U.S., if they have a problem with Hezbollah, they know very well that they need to address this with Iran. They tried it in 2006. It was a war only in Lebanon. Only Lebanon was the battlefield. And nothing happened after 2006. Despite all the destruction, Hezbollah said that he was victorious and winner. And even this time, if there's still one person, you know, that can stand tall, they will say that they won again.
That was Lebanese politician Paola Yacoubian. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. reminder of our top story this hour. The Israel military says it's killed the head of an elite Hezbollah unit along with other commanders in an airstrike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Firas Maqsad is with the Middle East Institute in Washington. He told this program that he thought Hezbollah had been weakened by their loss.
These are the elite fighting force of Hezbollah, sort of the equivalent of the Marines, so to speak, in the United States. And so this is the creme de la creme of Hezbollah's fighting force. And it's a pretty embarrassing and devastating blow.
And the headlines from the BBC Newsroom, a report on the attempted assassination of Donald Trump at a rally in July, says a communications breakdown was among the Secret Service lapses identified. And a court in Nairobi has ruled that Facebook's parent company, Meta, can be sued in Kenya, paving the way for an unfair dismissal case. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Millions of Ukrainians are struggling with mental health issues caused by the war, and not only are they coming together to fight Russia, but they're also coming together to find ways of tackling this sometimes invisible problem. Vitaly Shevchenko reports.
Maria Ivashchenko is one of the hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians who have lost loved ones in the war. Her husband Pavlo volunteered the day after Russia invaded in 2022. 6 months later, he was killed as Ukrainian forces went on a counteroffensive in Kherson region. To cope with her grief, Maria has been attending therapy classes where widows and mothers of fallen soldiers express their feelings, seek solace and closure by painting.
When you're painting, you externalize and process everything, all the memories and moments that you were afraid to relive and process. There's total trust. No one will judge you, whether you laugh or cry. They understand you unconditionally. There's no need to explain anything. This project has pulled many of us out of the abyss.
The project is called Alive, True Love Stories, and it was founded by Olena Sokalska.
Their painting is to depict something that reminds them of the time they spent together or of the dreams they had. They paint themselves, their husbands. Very often they paint angels. Their families or children are depicted as angels. There are a lot of landscapes showing places where they met or were happy together. These paintings mark the end of the life they had and the beginning of a new life.
In addition to the trauma of bereavement, the dangers and insecurities of war have deeply affected millions of Ukrainians. Ukrainian psychotherapist Anna Stativka explains.
What happens when the war starts? You lose their basic human resource, safety and stability. So it creates a lot of stress, some symptoms of chronic stress, anxiety, depression, apathy, insomnia. You cannot be for a long time in this hyper-alert state without consequences for your mental health and for your physical health.
The share of Ukrainians experiencing mental health issues has exploded since the start of the war. According to the health ministry, the number of patients reporting mental health problems this year has doubled since 2023, with antidepressant sales having jumped by almost 50% since 2021. One study even suggests that more than half of Ukrainians suffer from PTSD. And according to Anna Stativka, Ukrainian society has responded to the trauma of war by coming together.
People are much more ready to help to each other. People even are much more polite, even in supermarkets or public places. You see that so many people are volunteering, so many people are donating, so many people are trying to help.
Maria Ivashchenko is now raising 4 children on her own. But she's smiling again, even if there are tears sometimes. Her message to those who are struggling is clear.
Don't be afraid to talk to people. Get out of your bubble. Don't be alone. The most important thing is not to give up and not to think that you're alone in this world or that nobody cares. Oh, yes, they do. Life goes on. Our husbands did not go there so that we sit around crying, but so that we keep moving on, so that we keep living.
That report by the BBC's Vitaly Shevchenko. Now, obesity is one of the world's greatest health problems, with more than a billion people living with the condition, according to a recent survey in the British medical journal The Lancet. But a new type of blood test could provide an early warning for the medical profession of diabetes and other obesity-related complications in children. The test has been devised by researchers at the Steno Diabetes Centre in Copenhagen. Jens Christian Holm is head of the Children's Obesity Clinic at Holbæk University Hospital in Denmark and one of the principal authors of the study. What does this new test show?
It's actually quite a revolution, because before we had like 5 fatty lipids in our bloodstream that we could measure had some relationship to developing disease in your heart and your vessels, cardiovascular disease. But with this new study, we are able to investigate hundreds, if not thousands, of these lipids in the bloodstream. And we have identified 142 lipids, which show a relationship with developing relative risk to cardiovascular disease later on. It is really, really important because it elevates our clinical services to be more able to evaluate how the degree of obesity in children, adults, and growing up affect the body. And the study shows that we are able to make these lipids better, make a less worse profile during treatment of obesity.
So it's not as if the presence of these particular lipids or fatty acids show that a child is more predisposed to becoming obese?
That's a very good question, and I really think we should understand that obesity is many things, and we are in the start to unravel, understand how obesity is affecting normal physiology and how it goes into an abnormal physiology, abnormal metabolism, and how thereby changes the body in a way that deteriorates health. So with these lipids, we have new tools, many new tools, actually hundreds of tools, which can make a much more of a pattern recognition and thereby also help us in order to differentiate our patients to see how they respond. Because if you take maybe 1,000 children, adolescents living with obesity and treat them, they will have alternate responses. Some will respond more or less well. Some will develop more or less higher fatty lipids in the bloodstream. And we actually know this because we can see in this study that 38% exhibit a high fat in their liver, and approximately 28% exhibit what we call dyslipidemia, which is known as high cholesterols. And these high cholesterols, they translate directly into later coming cardiovascular disease. So with these new hundreds of lipids, we can make a much more precise and refined measurement of what's going on in the body at a certain time point, and thereby also measuring what's happening later on during treatment. It can thereby help us what I would call personalized treatment. And the high point as a pediatrician like me, my vision has always been to improve health during growth and development and thereby elevate physical, mental, and social thriving, which is the ultimate goal beyond any chronic disease that is seen in pediatrics. So with this system, and we have approximately more than 30 previous studies, we are being able to reduce the degree of elevated blood pressure, elevated cholesterols, bullying and appetite, and increasing quality of life, mood and body self-esteem, only using a few hours per patient per year.
That was Jens Christian Holm, head of the Children's Obesity Clinic at Holbæk University Hospital in Denmark. And that's it from this edition of NewsHour from me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London. Goodbye.